Third case, and we'll take a break after this one, is our third case is 17-2046, United States versus Qualls. Mr. Hopkins?
Yeah, may I please the court? I'm Lance Hopkins. I'm here for Mr. Qualls. And I guess right out the gate, I'd like to talk about the seven factors of Gordon and Elias. And I submit to the court that once those factors are applied to the situation here, I believe the district court abused its discretion in not allowing my client to withdraw his guilty plea under Rule 11 D2B. Now, going through these factors,
Before you address those factors, there's kind of a preliminary question that seems pretty substantial. The government argues that the argument you're now making, which is about the voluntariness of the confession, is not the argument, as I recall, that you made below. You made below, you said he wanted to contest the admissibility of his confession. You didn't argue at all that it was knowing and voluntary. You didn't discuss the Gordon factors. That wasn't even part of your argument. How do we get to that now?
Well, when you look at what happened below, the replacement counsel, Mr. Bridgman, I believe is his name, Mr. Benjamin, filed the amended motion to withdraw a plea. The government filed a response. And the judge, district judge, set it for hearing, but the judge never actually had a hearing and just went ahead and entered an order. And in the order, the district court applied those seven factors and went through all of them. So
your position is that even though you didn't challenge the voluntariness because the district court considered it in going through the factors, that now allows you to challenge it, you're no longer challenging it on the basis that you did below. And do you have any authority for that?
Well, yeah, I believe since we did, the court applied the seven factors, so it's not a plain error analysis because those issues were litigated before the court. And I think if you look at...
they weren't litigated because you didn't argue them. District court discussed them briefly, just going through the factors, but nobody argued about them. So I don't know that you could say they were litigated.
Well, I think Mr. Benjamin at the district court in his brief, he mentioned in there that that Mr. Qualls did not derive any benefit from entering a plea.
Right, but that's different than arguing it wasn't knowing and voluntary.
I thought from my reading of that motion, I thought that I thought that's what he was going after.
Okay.
But his factor number one would be assertion of innocence. And in Mr. Benjamin's motion, he declares his desire to challenge the admissibility of the confession from the standpoint that the agents executed a no-knock warrant and went into Mr. Qualls' house and utilized flashbang grenades and things like that, and that affected his ability to voluntarily confess. In his motion, he expressed a desire to do that, to attack the admissibility of the confession. So I believe what we have here is a legal assertion of innocence. He's claiming his legal innocence by challenging that confession. So that would be your argument as to factor one. Factor two, prejudice to the government. We believe there would be no prejudice to the government if my client was allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. This case never went to trial. The U.S. Attorney's Office would simply have to prosecute the case through a jury trial or work out some type of plea agreement if they were able to work out a plea agreement. Factor number three, delay in filing the motion. Now, I'll concede that there were a few months that went by before the motion was filed. But in the context of the situation, I don't believe there was a real delay because sentencing had not been set. After the change of plea hearing, if you look at the docket, this case was just sitting around. And in November, in late November, it was in December of 2015, Mr. Qualls filed a motion to withdraw the guilty plea. Then not long after, when Mr. Benjamin got in the case, he filed an amended motion to withdraw the plea. The sentencing had not been set at that time, and the sentencing did not actually occur until November of 2016. So we have an 11, the sentencing hadn't been set, and it was not held until 11 months, almost a year, after the motion to withdraw a guilty plea was filed. So we'd submit that there was really, in this context, no real delay. Factor number four, inconvenience to the court. We argue there would be no inconvenience to the court. The sentencing hearing had not yet been scheduled. All that would have been required, I mean, at the time of the filing of the motion to withdraw a plea, the sentencing hearing had not been scheduled. So all that would have been required of the district court would have been to either conduct a trial, or if they were able to work out a plea agreement, conduct another change of plea hearing. Factor number five, assistance of counsel. Mr. Qualls' first attorney, I don't think anyone could argue that he basically pled my client to a life sentence.
Well, that by itself isn't problematic unless it wasn't voluntary, I guess. I mean, if he didn't know what he was doing, and I guess what's your argument about that? I mean, the district court repeated several times the potential sentence, several times.
And I can see that, you know, when you read the transcript, they did repeat that several times. I don't deny that, but, you know, looking at the record, having communicated with Mr. Qualls and spoke to Mr. Benjamin, I don't believe he really understood he was looking at a life sentence when he entered the plea that day.
What's your basis for arguing that?
Just based on my conversations with my client. That's, and I think also a basis for arguing that would be nobody in their right mind would just enter a plea to life in prison, knowing they were going to die in prison. That's basically what he did. He pled to a life sentence. So, having had my client plead to a life sentence, without my client deriving any consideration, any benefit from the plea, I don't believe my client had effective assistance of counsel at that change of plea hearing. Factor number six, plea not knowingly, not voluntarily. Again, it all harkens back to my client received the same actual sentence that he would have received had he gone to trial and been convicted. Life. Had my client understood that he was receiving, I mean, I realize the transcript would indicate otherwise, but had he understood that he was not receiving any consideration for his plea, that he was basically pleading to a life sentence, again, I don't think he would have done it. I don't think anybody or any reasonable person would knowingly and voluntarily just plead to a life sentence. Factor number seven, waste of judicial resources. We'd submit to the court that this, had my client been allowed to withdraw his plea, there would have been no waste of judicial resources. It certainly wouldn't have been a waste of judicial resources to allow him to challenge the admissibility of his confession, to allow that to be litigated, a motion to be filed, a hearing to be held, especially considering the aspect of the flashbang grenades and, you know, things that can happen with flashbang grenades, like temporary loss of vision, temporary loss of hearing, the disorientation that comes with the flashbang grenades. Certainly wouldn't be a waste of judicial resources to adjudicate that. I do believe the voluntariness of that confession is a concern, given those factors. And I don't think it would be a waste of judicial resources to reopen the plea bargaining process and to see if there would be some type of plea agreement that would be worked out where my client would at least receive some consideration.
What was the guideline sentence? here?
1,440 months.
What was the guideline range?
It was 43 and a six. 43.
What was the imprisonment range on the low end?
It was life.
So the minimum sentence he was going to receive here was life?
Yes, sir.
I don't think that's right.
It was 25 to 50 with the enhancement he had.
Well, but what I'm talking about...
For each count.
What I mean is, under the guy, if you're going to have consecutive sentences here. You've got four counts. And even though you had...
Why are they mandatorily consecutive?
Under the guidelines, they are, because you have to run those counts consecutive to get closer to the guideline sentence. In other words, you've got a guideline sentence here of 200 years. So what the district judge did was he gave him the maximum of 50 years on each count, and he ran those consecutive to get the 200, because that was a guideline range.
I understand that, but couldn't there have been a lesser sentence that was not as onerous or a departure downward?
I mean, I would agree that...
Qualls didn't know what his sentence was going to be at the time he pled out.
That's correct, but... the judge no doubt had discretion to do a downward variance or to run the counts concurrent. But when you really think about it, that would have been a really large downward, to say, to get him to 50 years. I mean, for him not to, he's in his late 20s, realistically, for him not to have gotten a life sentence, you're probably looking at about a 50-year sentence. We've got a guideline range of 1,440 months, and 50 years is 600 months. So we would have had a downward variance from 1,440 down to 600. That'd be awfully tough for a district judge to go down that far at a sentencing. In fact, it would be difficult for a district judge to go down that far and have it upheld by this court or any other appellate court. The size of that variance would be challenged by the government, I'm sure. So, if court doesn't mind, I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
You may. Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is James Braun, and I'm an assistant United States attorney in Albuquerque. When Mr. Qualls pled guilty, he waived his right to have his plea taken by a district judge and consented to proceed in front of a magistrate judge. And under this court's longstanding precedent going back over 20 years, a magistrate judge has the authority to conduct a Rule 11 colloquy and to accept a felony guilty plea. And here, the magistrate judge unequivocally accepted Mr. Qualls' plea. And because of that, when Mr. Qualls moved to withdraw his guilty plea 7 months later, he was required to show a fair and just reason for why he should be allowed to do so. Now, in the district court, what the defendant argued was primarily that he was allowed to withdraw his plea for any reason or no reason under Rule 11b1, basically arguing that this court's precedent was wrong. As kind of an aside, in one paragraph and a half a page at the end of his motion, he argued that if the district judge didn't agree with him there, that he could show a fair and just reason because he wanted to file a motion to suppress. He didn't address any of the seven factors that this court has identified for a district court to consider in ruling on a motion to withdraw. He simply said he wanted to file a motion to suppress. And he didn't go into much detail on that. Today he argues about the effects of flashbang devices and how that could cause disorientation and maybe make his confession involuntary. He didn't argue that below. And he had 7 months after he pled guilty until he filed his motion to withdraw his plea. And he had 5 months of continuances before that, before he pled guilty, to articulate what his suppression motion would be, if he truly had a good faith basis for moving to suppress. And the district court correctly found that that wasn't enough. Under this court's decision in Hamilton, even a claim of legal innocence requires that it be a credible claim, and that the defendant put forward some evidence and argue what the legal basis would be. He argued no legal basis whatsoever. But on top of that, it's not even clear that suppression of his confession would result in his legal innocence anyway, because as the government argued in response to the motion to withdraw, there was other evidence that supported the prosecution against the defendant, physical evidence that was seized from his phone. He didn't say that he was going to move to suppress the physical evidence. The fact that the photographs of his daughter were found on his phone, that the email address tied to him had sent those photographs over the internet. And so the government likely would have been able to convict him anyway. So even suppression of his confession would not equal legal innocence. So the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to withdraw the guilty plea on that basis. But that's not even the basis why we're here today. Because on appeal, the defendant completely changed course and instead argued that his plea was not knowing and voluntary, a ground that he had not raised below. And I think Judge Moritz asked if there was any authority for why he could do that now. In fact, the authority is to the contrary. In the Muhammad case, which the government cites in its brief, there the defendant had argued in the district court only that he should be allowed to withdraw his plea because it was not knowing and voluntary. The district court, as the district court did here, went through the seven factors, and yet the Tenth Circuit held that the defendant had waived arguing any other factors on appeal that he hadn't argued below. And so the defendant shouldn't be heard to argue the knowing and voluntary nature of his plea now when he didn't argue it below. But even if the court does address that argument, it should reject the argument on the merits, because the question in determining whether a plea is knowing and voluntary is whether the defendant, when he entered the plea, was aware of the direct consequences of his guilty plea. And here, there can really be no question that the defendant was fully aware when he pled guilty that he faced up to 200 years in prison.
Why wouldn't a reasonable defendant roll the dice, given what he faced?
Well, as we argued in our brief, there are other reasons why the defendant might have chosen to plead guilty, knowing what he had done to his daughter, and perhaps not wanting to put her through a trial, and perhaps wanting the moral satisfaction of having accepted responsibility for what he did. And there is something to that. In his reply brief, the defendant dismisses that, basically saying that there has to be some tangible benefit. He cites no authority that there has to be a tangible benefit received from a guilty plea. And in fact, one case the government cites is Fields versus Gibson, where the defendant, Bobby Joe Fields, had pled guilty straight up to a capital crime in Oklahoma and ultimately was executed after receiving the death penalty on a guilty plea. If that was knowing and voluntary, then certainly a sentence of 200 years can be knowing and voluntary. And basically what the defendant is doing is reversing the correct order of the analysis, arguing, well, look at the sentence he received. Nobody in their right mind would do that. And that's not the question. The question is, what did he know at the time he pled guilty? And from the time of arraignment, where the magistrate judge made sure he was fully aware that he could be sentenced up to 200 years, there was a discussion.
Was it
about
clear these would be consecutive?
That was the discussion, that
okay,
each count carried a maximum of 30 years if there was no enhancement, 50 years if there was an enhancement. Mm-hmm. The government's position, as we made clear from the very beginning, is that the defendant had a qualifying prior conviction that would make his statutory maximum 50 years, mandatory minimum 25, and that those could be stacked. And again, it was as if the magistrate judge was going above and beyond by making sure that he understood not only was that the statutory maximum for each count, but those could be imposed consecutively. And so the magistrate judge confirmed, you understand you can be sentenced up to 200 years. That was at the arraignment. Then we have the Form 13 PSR prepared, which again, even though probation ultimately got it wrong, they concluded that it was a 30-year max, that they didn't take his prior into account, that was still a guideline range of 1,440 months. And to answer Judge Timkovich's question, that was the guideline range without the enhancement. The guideline range with the enhancement was 2,400 months. And the reason for that, that it's not a range, is because the guideline would be life, but for the fact that we have the statutory maximum. And so because of the statutory maximum, when they're imposed consecutively, the guideline range became 2,400 months. But the defendant was certainly aware that he was looking at a de facto life sentence, whether it was 30 years per count or 50 years per count. He knew that from the arraignment. He knew that from the Form 13 pre-sentence report that was prepared, and yet he still chose to proceed with a guilty plea. And at that guilty plea proceeding, the magistrate judge again confirmed that there was an argument about what the statutory maximum would be. The government's position was that it was 50 years per count, and that the defendant could therefore be sentenced up to 200 years. The defendant indicated no hesitation about his understanding of that. He indicated nothing that he had been promised something else. He said he understood. Now, knowing what he could be sentenced to and choosing to go forward anyway makes his plea knowing and voluntary. Now, the defendant's argument would make more sense if, hypothetically, the district judge had indicated to the lawyers, you know, looking at these facts, I'm probably going to impose a statutory maximum sentence. And the lawyer hadn't told that to Mr. Qualls before he pled guilty. But that's not this case. There's no evidence of that. The evidence is that the defendant knew he could be sentenced up to 200 years, and he chose to plead guilty anyway. Now, why would he do that? The statutory mandatory minimum, was 25 years per count. But there's no language in the statute, like in 924C, that says those sentences have to be served consecutive to each other or to any other sentence. So the judge could have varied downward to 25 years. And certainly, the defendant was hoping for that, I'm sure. There was no guarantee that he was going to get 200 years. Pleading guilty offered him that chance to throw himself on the mercy of the court, show contrition, and ask for some light at the end of the tunnel. Instead, we see at the sentencing hearing the judge feels like he hasn't shown contrition at all. And that plays into, ultimately, the punishment of 200 years. And so there was a reason for him to plead guilty under these circumstances. There was no guarantee that he was going to get 200 years. He certainly hoped for less than that, and he had the opportunity to argue for less than that. Now, in his reply brief, and here this morning, for the very first time, the defendant finally goes through all seven of the Hamilton factors. The Gordon factors. But even now, the three most important factors are assertion of innocence, knowing involuntary plea, and assistance of counsel. And even now, he can't articulate a viable suppression argument. He can't articulate why that would result in legal innocence. And he's standing by the same argument that his plea wasn't knowing involuntary, which just doesn't withstand scrutiny. As far as assistance of counsel, there's no indication that he received anything less than effective assistance of counsel. There's no record indicating that his attorney was in any way deficient. And so the court can rest there. Those are the three primary factors, and if the defendant does not establish that they weigh in his favor, the court doesn't have to consider the other factors, as the district court found below. But even if you look at prejudice to the government, as the government argued in response to the defendant's motion below, there was prejudice to the government by this seven-month delay. And 7 months is a significant delay when you're talking about a child victim who was 3 years old at the time this occurred. In that circumstance, I would imagine every month that goes by makes it more difficult for that child to remember what happened and be able to testify in court about what happened. But in addition to that, the prosecutor described how the two agents that had been involved in taking the defendant's confession, one had been the case agent at the time and she had been transferred out of state, and the other one who became the case agent, she had also been transferred out of state. And so there would have been prejudice to the government by this significant seven-month delay. And so even if the court considers the other factors, they weigh in favor. of the district court having denied the motion to withdraw the guilty plea.
Counsel, can I just, before your time is up, I understand you're trying to cover all your bases, but I'm wondering if you can tell me just the role of your waiver argument today. I mean, that's where you started, and I guess I'm wondering if you think that waiver takes care of the case or the first issue in the case or not, given the amount of time you've spent on your backup arguments.
And I am trying to cover all my
bases.
Yeah,
of course.
But
I understand.
What I said at the very beginning, that would take care of the case, because if the defendant has waived that argument that he made in his opening brief that his plea was not knowing and voluntary, then there's nowhere else to go.
Okay, his so other, you think that ends the case? That's it?
We do.
Okay.
And his second argument, he agreed, his argument that he should have been allowed to withdraw his plea for any reason or no reason under Rule 11D1, even he agrees that he's just preserving that for further review.
Okay. Thank you.
We would ask that the court affirm the district court's denial of the motion to withdraw the guilty plea.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
First, in response, government relies heavily on Fields v. Gibson, the state court case out of Oklahoma. That case is an opposite, and here's why. Fields did not move to withdraw his plea until well after the sentencing hearing, well after the judge had imposed the death sentence on him. My client filed a motion to withdraw his guilty plea at a time when the sentencing had not even been scheduled. In fact, the sentencing didn't even occur until 11 months later. So, in fact, the whole rule at issue here, Rule 11D2B, the Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure at issue only applies if a person files a motion to withdraw their plea prior to sentencing. So the Fields was post-sentencing. That really doesn't apply. And as at the end of the day, the district court in this case issued a written order where the district court went through all seven of the factors of Gordon, went through them thoroughly. That was adjudicated, and we're entitled to raise that issue, and it's entitled to de novo review. It was adjudicated at the district court level. As my time is starting to run out, I just think, again, at the end of the day, what we have here is we have a young man who basically pled to a life sentence without he entered into a guilty plea. He waived his right to jury trial. He waived his right to other defenses, such as the insanity defense. He waived his right to challenge the admissibility of evidence and derived actually nothing in return. I just don't think it speaks well of the judicial system when we have a situation where a person just enters a guilty plea to a life sentence and waives all the rights.
Thank you, counsel. We understand the arguments. Counselor excused, and the case shall be